I'm going to be fairly brief this time because Lindsay has the most incredible pictures to show you.
That, by the way, is the Eden Valley in Cumbria. That's not the
In 1968, the Broadcasting Commission was endeavouring to get us more power and a better frequency because the pirates were coming off the air, or were off the air at that time. And the negotiations that were going on looked very favourable indeed. So a chap called Daffy Don Allen, people may remember him, I've got a picture there. That's in 12. And if you zoom in.
Sorry, yeah. I've opened it in the wrong one. It's all right. Hang on. We're getting
anyway.
Straight.
You said.
That's it.
Lindsay hasn't caught up.
If things work out the way we are expecting them to work out, all these big name disc jockeys from the pirate radio stations are going to be knocking on our door, because we anticipated becoming the equivalent of Radio Luxembourg for the daytime, covering all of the UK. He said, I would suggest you take yourself off to his hometown in Canada and get some real experience working in commercial radio. And I said, well, my sister has just a year ago gone to live in Tennessee. She'd been to the Vidal Sassoon's hairdressing school in Manchester and got a contract to go and work for a company in Atlanta, Georgia, but was immediately posted to Knoxville, Tennessee. So I said, no, I'll just go and spend a couple of weeks with Pauline, tour the radio stations, pick up what I can. And I believed in a three-week holiday, I'd learn all I needed to learn. But each of the stations I went to see, they said, oh, you've got to come and work for us, because anyone remotely British, you couldn't go wrong in those days in America. So WNOX, the station I went to work for, made me an offer I couldn't believe. It was a one-year contract. And if you go on to the next one, unbeknownst to me, I spent a week in London prior to flying out to the States, where they'd been promoting the heck out of me on air. I thought I was going to learn the business from the ground up. But no, they put me on the breakfast show, and this station covered seven surrounding states with a colossal audience. They said they were importing one of Britain's top disc jockeys. And the first I knew about my name change was I had to go and collect my tickets from BOAC in London. And the girl said, you're very young to be a knight. I said, I'm not a knight. But it's made out to Sir Bernard J. Quayle. I said, oh, there's been an error there. And check all the passports and everything else. But they christened me Sir Bernard, Knight of the Turntable, which stuck with me for a number of years. But they promoted my arrival, and they had 2,000 people at the airport when I arrived. The first I knew of this happening was when the lady on the plane said, would Sir Bernard please remain seated while the passengers disembark? Whatever for. Then they rolled the red carpet out. The University of Tennessee marching band was there. I was presented with the very first TR-6 to be imported into the States with my name painted down the side. We had an airplane flying around, towing a banner, welcome to Knoxville, Sir Bernie baby, and things like that. And the next one you can see.
How old were you then? About 26.
I was 28.
28.
Yeah.
Just getting it in perspective.
They then had a cavalcade. They had 80 vehicles from the airport back to the radio station's grounds where they had a huge garden party. And there were two different people. There was the persona they'd created, and there was me saying, my God, I can't believe this is happening. It was unbelievable. But I got to do all manner of things. A lot of MC work. I did a TV series for the local ABC affiliate and various commercials that went out on a national scale, which was very nice because they paid handsomely. But I was spending it as quickly as I was making it in those days. My 1 year contract turned into 11 years and 2 months in actual fact. But I was getting very homesick, my parents were getting elderly, and I really wanted to come home. And came back to the Isle of Man at the beginning of 1980. And I did work for the radio station for a short while, but it was at a time when they were really economically strapped, and they made a bunch of us redundant. So I was the last in, and I was first out. And I'd only just got married, not to Lindsay, and the girl I was married to then had been offered a job with a newspaper in Johannesburg. So we went to Johannesburg, spent 5 years out there, and the troubles were just beginning, and her boys were about to be called up for the army, so we returned to the Isle of Man. But I said I'd show you a brief thing, if I may. Oh, this is... Yes, go back to that one, just to tell you briefly. In 97, I got fed up with people telling me, or the record book showing that the Bee Gees were from Manchester. All the record books showed that. And I knew better. So they were coming over to Britain to do a couple of gigs. And I contacted their manager. They said they got a very tight schedule. They wouldn't have a lot of time. And I wanted to do an in-depth interview series with them. So he said, you can come down to London for the 2 days we were there and just hang around in the hope you'll get it. Couldn't promise anything. But then he said, if you've got time, just before Christmas is when they all get together as a family in Florida. And I was invited out to spend time with them in Florida. Went out, and the guys were just fantastic. I got on so well with them, and with their mum in particular, which is Barbara in the middle. She's 86 now, and she's still going strong. I spent the first morning with her and then lunch with her, getting some background. Then I interviewed each one of them separately, because you put them together, it's like trying to interview the Goon Show. They're bouncing off each other all the time. And they said things in the interviews with me that their manager, who was listening on the intercom, kept running and said, you can't say that. I said, that's just Bernie, it's all right. I said, that's the media. I've got things on tape that would embarrass them. But they knew they could trust me. And there was a sort of kind of respect back and forth. When Morris died, I'd only just returned. I'd spent a weekend with Robin at his home in Tain. And Barbara, the mum, telephoned me, and I knew he was seriously ill, and said, I'm trying to get a hold of Robin. He's not answering his mobile. Do you know where he is? And I said, well, he's actually on his way down to London to do the Richard and Judy show. And so she couldn't reach him. And on the programme, Richard was saying, I believe your brother's getting better. He said, oh yes, you know, he's squeezing his daughter's hand and his eye movements and so on. And I knew, because Barbara just told me, we're just waiting for Robin to arrive, we'll turn the life support off. And that was a Friday evening, and he'd gone. And I went in that night to record an obituary, and the news department says, you're sick, we've just seen he's getting better. I said, just, it's there if you need it. And the first I knew about it was Robin flew out the next day. At 3 o'clock Sunday morning, the first call to my home phone was from IRN in London. And the family had given my name as a close family friend, and the world media was telephoning me here in London, just getting quotes about it. So I was quite flattered that they should have thought so confidently that I would represent them in such a way. Anyway, moving right along. What's the next picture?
Blank.
That's it. Right. Okay. You saw what the station looked like in 1967. Oops, sorry. Nowadays, we are very much involved in Facebook. And I was asked to do this on our Facebook page.
Is he all right?
Yeah, it's not good one. Oh, there you are.
In through the security door into reception and down the main hallway where was a collection of photographs from the Manx Bay Festival and classic TTs which are from the Getty Collection. Into the main office area where each presenter has his own workstation, this room is shared by some of the newspapers. My desk, a picture of a holiday day. And to my right, it's Alex Britton's workstation. In front of him, it's Catherine Nicol. In front of her, it's Stu Peters, Terry Kringle, and then Bob Harrison. In this studio, programs such as Sunday Opinion, where there are a number of guests, are able to sit around a table, and the program would then be either broadcast live or pre-recorded. On the top floor, we also have the main studios. We're going to creep in on Chris Kidman. He is expecting this special.
Plus, all the international sports between now and 5 o'clock. Oh, we'll even chug in a bit of music, starting with Travis at Flowers in the Window.
The first thing to my right is our telephone screen system. Now, in the olden days, we used to have a little box with switches on, but now it's a touchscreen telephone system. I touch that and the phone call is answered. We can also see the person's identity on the phone call. You can see phone numbers. The only thing it can't say is people withhold their telephone calls. It makes life a lot easier for us presenters. These two screens you see in front of us here now are what we call our Myriad Playout screens. The right-hand side is what we call the log. At the moment, it's playing Flowers in the Window by Travis. You can see that because it's blue. Then we're going to have Station Identity, so obviously you know you're listening to Manx Radio. And then we're going to have Cranberries and Dreams. And those individual slides on there have their own cart numbers. And the cart wall is on the left-hand side. So cart number 16457 is here. So if I put in the details, 16457. That will go to Flowers in the Window, and it shows that match in the man.
But then, late at night, the main screen for me is the one on the far left of the control board. This is where I see the emails and the texts. It's where I bring up the weather forecast. But most importantly, it's where I have my own database. And this is where I have a total of 2,500 tracks. It's only a Word document, but I can quickly find anything I want. We'll simply type in an artist's name, in this case, Jim Reeves. Then we'll scroll through and see how many Jim Reeves songs I have. We'll stop on Moonlight and Roses. It's disc 38, and it's track number 10. So then, I move to my little collection, which is sitting on the desk to the left of me, and there's 140 discs in here. Find disc 38. Then I have to place the disc into a tray, which goes into the CD player, and it's all ready to play. Full 24 hours of broadcast.
That's it?
Yes. I'd like to share something with you. You saw a picture on my desk. When Lindsay and I were married in 2004, right? It was in her sister's garden in Adelaide, in Australia. And I gave my video camera to Lindsay's nephew, who shot a bit of video of our wedding. When I got it back, I thought, that reminds me of something, of a well-known movie, which I happen to have on a DVD. And so I've just mixed a little bit together. See, what do you think? It's very short.
Originally, and that is our license. It's all stations east of the Mississippi begin with W, and west of the Mississippi begin with a K. So the station I went to work for was the third oldest station in the United States, and you endeavored to try and find a name applicable to the area. So WNOX was Knox, Knoxville, Tennessee. And there are one or two other variations like that. In Knoxville, there were actually nine radio stations just serving the Knoxville area. Some very small, about the same power output as our station here. But ours was a huge station, one I worked for. And in the morning, at breakfast show, the surrounding states, if you look at Tennessee, it's surrounded by seven other states. And they could all hear our station. Anybody else got any questions?
I'll just make this very quick, Pam, because I know it's getting on now. I'll basically show you my photos of the tracking and explain to you why I did it. Okay.
I'll click and move if you want to stand and talk to the people.
Okay. Let me start now.
Tell you, I'm very proud of this lady, what she achieved. Not only Machu Picchu, but she's done the Moonlight Marathon in Edinburgh.
I did the moonwalk in Edinburgh in May, which was 26 miles, my first ever marathon at 60. I'll just explain to you briefly, the Inca Trail, for those of you that don't know, I'm sure most of you do, Machu Picchu is this most amazing city, and it's high up in the Andes, high up in the Andes Mountains, and it was discovered in 1911 by Hiram Bingham. He was actually looking for something else and found this wonderful city, and it's just absolutely amazing. But the thing is, because the Peruvians were invaded by the Spanish, The Spanish destroyed a lot of the records and killed a lot of the people who had the knowledge. So they're never actually sure how it came to be there and why and who actually was there. But they're gradually unearthing stuff and finding things out. But the trail we did, although it was, say, only 26 miles, we did it over 4 days because the highest point is actually 14,000 feet. But this was a trail that was done 500 years ago by the Inca people to get to this city. And on the way, there are other cities as well, although not quite as big as Machu Picchu, that they used on the way there for outposts and things like that. So basically, I saw an advert in the paper saying that they wanted people to raise money for the Isle of Man Children's Centre to go on this trek to Machu Picchu. Came home, said to Bernie, I've got to do something adventurous for my 60th year. So I went along to the initial talk, and there was 84 people turned up, and 30 of us got chosen, so I was really chuffed. And there was a good mixture of age groups. There was about maybe 6 of us who were the older age group, and then sort of, a lot younger, but it was quite a mixture. And the amazing thing was I didn't know any of them before I went, and we all came back so with such a bond, and we're all having a year's meet-up on the 6th of November, which will be a year to the date we all went. And we all still keep in touch with each other vaguely, sort of thing, and, it's really nice. Basically, this is Paddington Bear. I thought I should take him back to Peru. So there was a couple of us having from Paddington. So this was all at Milan Airport, waiting to go. This is the city of Cusco. Now, initially, we all went to Cusco, which is, I think it's 3,200 feet, something like that, to get us acclimatised. And we stayed in a fabulous hotel, which, unfortunately, don't click it on yet. Unfortunately, I haven't got pictures of, but we walked in and it was done in the Spanish style, where it was all done around a courtyard, and it was absolutely fabulous. And they looked after us so well. This is a beautiful, beautiful church. Cusco itself is full of history, very lot of Spanish influence, but the Peruvians are very, very proud of their heritage and they hate the Spanish. There's a lot of street sellers, but they're all licensed and they're not allowed to pester you. And if they do pester you, the police come up and ship them, and they know that they'll get the licenses taken off you if they harass you too much. But most of them are really pleasant. They all spoke brilliant English, of course, and make you ashamed that you don't know any of their language at all. So that was the main square of the city. And when we arrived, we all got taken to the hotel, and then we got taken for lunch up on, you can go on to the next one, I think shows you, oh no, that's the top of the church, which is beautiful, just click on, there should be one there of the restaurant, this is the restaurant where we all went to have lunch up here. It was lovely, it was really nice. But you can see how lovely the buildings are. But it's actually built in the bowl of a range of mountains. And when you get out of the city, there's a lot of poverty, as you get in a lot of these places. And a lot of them build their houses out of mud bricks. And then when it rains, they all get washed away. So it's awfully sad. But this is the city. It's all built up because it's in the bowl of a mountain. And they took us round the whole city. And it was boiling hot, and we're not onto that one yet. In these streets, all these little shops were all run by families, and behind them they opened out into courtyards, and that's where everybody lived in the houses. But all the whole family would run these little shops, the mothers, the grandmothers, the children. There was an awful lot of children who were dressed up in the local dress. And you could take photos, and you gave them one of whatever their money was. And they did ask you not to give them any more than that, because the problem was they were trying to educate these children, and if they earned too much money begging, they wouldn't send them to school. So you had to, you know, although you felt sorry for them, you couldn't give them the money. But they were all so polite and so well-mannered, they were lovely. So this is Cusco, all the streets. Now, the next day, we arrived there, I think it was on the Monday. On the Tuesday, they took us to some of their famous, forts and things. And this one, that they were pronouncing that all the time, sexy woman. So they thought that was a great joke, the guides on the bus. You know, they were taking us to see sexy woman. But it was actually this amazing fortress. And when you hear about the pyramids and how they built the pyramids, these huge bricks and stones, when you see the stones on these, they're absolutely amazing. This is. Do you want to just run on a bit so they can see? See the size of the stones. That was our guide, Effie. He was one of our guides. If you go on, there's another one which shows a huge... Oh, that's looking down, so you can see how high up we were. What they did the second day we were there was they took us all round as high as they could and everything to get us acclimatised. And I have to say, I felt very, very sick. And it was very hot as well. So that's looking down on... See this? Isn't that amazing? You know, and... When you hear about the pyramids and stuff, and you see stuff like that, you see it wasn't just Egypt; it was all over the place. There's actually a stone, a part of the stones there that's done in the shape of a puma, which is all part of their religious thing. Right, do you want to move on? That's just another site, Pukapakara, that we went to as well. I've brought my albums with me because I took 300 photographs, which I've condensed down. But if you want to have a look at them afterwards, you can, but I know it's getting late. So this is Pukapakara. As I say, that they're just starting to unearth these things in the last 10 years and finding all these amazing sites. And they're really building up their tourist industry over there. So this was the walk they took us on after they'd taken us to see all the sites. They walked us all over the place to get us used to the heat and the climate, because Cusco is 3,200. Click on. This is the day we were actually going up, starting on the Inca Trail. And this is the last town before you go on the trail. And you've got loads of people there selling you. You have to have the little rubber ferrules on the bottom of your hiking sticks. You weren't allowed to go without them on, because they were trying to preserve all the steps. There's lots of stone steps that were put there by the Incas. This is the river and the railway station here that can take you up by train up to Machu Picchu. If you click on, this is people who are just getting off the train. But this is, if you click on the next one, please. Sorry.
Mostly Americans.
Yeah, this is the passport place. Now, because it's so busy now, you have to have a permit to go up there. So our group obviously had a group permit, and you have to get your permit stamped and show your passport before you can even go on the trail at all, because they are trying to preserve it. So you can see this is just the start of it. And we sort of got up there and said, my goodness, we've only just started. Then we were all shattered. But it was very, very hot as well. This is looking down on one of the sites that we passed. I did have all the names, I'm sorry, but as we're sort of whizzing through. Now, this is the most amazing thing. The porters carried all the camping gear and the food and the bulk of our luggage that we took with us for the 4 days. The porters carried it for us. We had a backpack on every day with our water and our snacks and things that we needed for the day. But we were struggling up these massive mountains, and you'd suddenly hear porter, and we'd all stand back, and these porters would go running past you with all this stuff on the backs, taking it up to the campsite. And this was where we'd stop for lunch. I've got the photographs the wrong way round, but they put up the tents and had all the tables set, and we got served a 3-course lunch by these porters by the time we'd arrived there. This was the first stop for the night, and we walked all day from sort of, we started off from the hotel at 6:30 in the morning, and we got to the campsite about 6 o'clock at night, and the porters and chefs were all standing there clapping us in. There was actually 30 of them, 30 porters and chefs, and they all had designated duties, and there was toilet duties was the one that was the funniest. He had two of these, we used to call them the rocket grey tents, that he used to put up everywhere and dig a hole and be a loo on top of it. This was the first morning. You can see how swollen my face is already. I can't remember what height we were up to by then, but this is about 6. Don't keep whizzing on. This is about 6. That's about 6 o'clock in the morning. We got woken up every morning with cocoa tea. And what they have over there, they have the cocoa leaves, which is the same as cocaine. But they make tea out of it, and you chew it, and it helps with the altitude sickness. And it's quite legal over there, because it's not, it doesn't give you a high or anything. It's more of a medicine. They don't take it in great doses and end up, you know, all dilally. But it's quite legal over there, but they did warn us not to try to bring any back. So that was the first morning. These are all little two-man tents, and I shared with Glenda, who's got the little beauty place in Peel. I don't know if anybody knows her, Glenda Payne, but I shared with her anyway. This is Mark from the Children's Centre, who organised it all through a company in Manchester, and that was just showing how high we are up in the Andes. I don't know if you can see there. I know I look dreadful, but you got to the stage where you didn't care as long as you were comfortable and cool. And this is going up the mountain. This is heading, on the second day, we're heading up to the 14,000 feet, which is the highest one. It's called Dead Woman's Pass, and it's not because you're that shattered when you get up there that it kills you off. It's because if you actually look at through the mountains, they say it looks like a woman lying down. So they call it Dead Woman's Pass. So this is actually getting up there. And you see how cold it's on. It's 14,000 feet by now. We've all got our woolly hats on and everything. But this is where they reckon it's a woman's face, and then she's lying down here. But that was 14,000 feet there. Luckily, I got over my altitude sickness the first 2 days, and once we actually started the climb, I was fine. But there were people who got sick as we got higher. And it was, unfortunately, it affects everybody in different ways. But then, can you just go back a minute? The nice thing about this was I was really struggling to get up the last bit. It really was literally, you take half a dozen steps and stop because it was so high and the oxygen so lacking. But the ones who got there first, that there was like three groups. There was a younger group who got everywhere first. Then there was a sort of middle group, and then there was us tagging on at the end, half a dozen of us. And I was one of the second to last to get there. But while we were sort of still struggling up quite a way, all the ones who got there first were all lined across the top, and they're all going, come on, you can do it, you can do it. It was absolutely fabulous. There was such a camaraderie. It was absolutely brilliant. So that was the whole group. So this is going down now. We have to go back all the way down here to our camp, which took us most of the afternoon. We got to the camp about 7 o'clock at night, but you can just see how high it was. You don't want to? Yeah. Again, that's just showing the trail. You can't really tell from this, but these are the steps. These are the original Inca steps. They're still there from when they were put there 500 years ago. They do try and maintain them, obviously, but you can see by this time that the mist had started to come down, and we'd all bought these ponchos off the people in the last town before we started. Everybody had those. They only cost something like £1, you know, so you stuck one in your rucksack. That was our guide. This is one of the steepest parts that we went down. Okay, just was on a bit. Again, this is after lunch. It had brightened up during lunch, and then all of a sudden, as we started off again, all the mist came down. So it's a bit like Manannan's mist. You never know when it's going to be there. Just suddenly comes in. but it brightened up again later on because you can see I've taken my coat off again there, and although it's misty, it's very warm. And this is right on the edge of the mountain. It's all little tiny tracks, but it was fabulous. You didn't feel in danger at all, and the guides were fabulous. There was always four guides at the front and a guide and a doctor at the back, so nobody ever got left behind. And what they did say to us was, you might never do this again, so take your time, enjoy it, take your photographs, it's your trip. And they were fabulous. They never rushed you. It was absolutely fabulous. This again is another fortress on the way down, but you can see all the how they did all the terraces to grow vegetables and everything, even sort of all those years ago, a bit like the Chinese with all their rice fields. This is just some views of the mountains. This is called the cloud forest now that we're going through. And you can see why, because the clouds kept coming in and out, and you'd walk along and just a few minutes later that all the clouds will have gone and you'd have a completely different view. It was just amazing. It was so beautiful. It really was. That's the same view a few minutes later, so you can see how it is. It's just fabulous. This is the cloud forest. This is why it's called the cloud forest, because you've got all this greenery and these little tiny paths. But it was actually high up on a mountain. This is the last day, the last night. We actually stopped off at a big camp where there were showers and a little place where you could get a drink and buy a beef burger. It was fabulous after 3 days of trying to wash in a tent with a little bowl of water and wet wipes and everything. So that was nice. And this is, the porters were all going back that day because we were carrying on to Machu Picchu and then getting a coach back and a train back to Cusco. So the porters were all going, so we'd all had a collection. So they got them all together, the porters and the chefs, and presented them with what we collected. And then they all entertained us. They sang and they danced. And if you go on to the next one, you see them dancing with some of them. They're dancing with some of us. And they were absolutely fantastic. Most of these people are farmers. And they do this in the winter when there's no crops and things. And they're just waiting for the spring to come again. So they do these jobs in the winter to earn some money and keep themselves going. And they were absolutely fabulous. They really were. So we all sang O Land of Our Birth for them, which they thought was great. So this is going through the final permit place before you actually go on the last bit of the trek to Machu Picchu. So you can see how steep this is going up. Again, these are all the original steps that were done all those years ago by the Incas. And this is, we were all getting to the stage where we've been walking for hours and we said we must be nearly due for a break now. And then all of a sudden we saw the guide standing there. This is Interpunka, which means sun gate. And we said, oh, thank goodness for that, a rest. And he never said anything, he just had this grin on his face. And he climbed up these really steep steps, and when he got to the top, he just showed Bernie. This is what we saw, the first view of Machu Picchu, which was absolutely amazing. We were all very emotional by that time because we'd all been working towards it for 9 months and it was just unbelievable. So that was the first view, but we were still a good hour and a half away. This here, I'm sorry, do you want to go back? Yeah. This is actually a big hotel complex, and here again is a permit place, and you can actually get your passport stamped to say that you've been to Machu Picchu and the date and everything. But a lot of the Americans go up and just stay in the hotel and then walk round it, and the guides are very scathing of them. But to be honest with you, it is the trek is hard going, and if you do want to see it, it is nice to go and get the train up and see it that way. You know, it's lovely. But this again, you can see how swollen I am with all the water pressure and everything, because we're drinking gallons of water every day. But this is the rock where we were in Machu Picchu there. That was, say, our first thing of it, yeah. So, oh, sorry, go back. So this is where we're starting down now on the trail. Now, there's a little trail here, which is the one that you normally see in all the photographs. I thought that was the Inca Trail. I thought that's what we were doing. So imagine when I saw what we actually were doing, it was quite a shock. That's actually the road, and it zigzags because obviously it's up a mountain, so it all zigzags. So we're all starting off back down to Machu Picchu there. That's the picture you normally see. Okay, don't just whiz on. Yeah, and this is as we're getting nearer. You can see how vast it is. It's just unbelievably huge. You just don't know how they ever built it. Don't whiz on. Yeah, this is on the trail now, just actually getting there. And this is the R factor, the next one, I think. Yes, there we are. There's loads of llamas, because, of course, they are native to there, and they use them a lot. And they just roam freely around the whole of the city, and you can be walking along this little tiny ledge, and they'll suddenly come along and hop past you and budge you off. You know, quite funny. But they're all right. This is all our guides. Excuse me. So they were absolutely fantastic. We had 5 guides and the doctor. And they were absolutely brilliant, they were. And they all spoke perfect English. So we all split up into little groups, and each guide took us round and told us all the relevant bits. It's just too much to go into because it's absolutely huge, but the way it's built is amazing. Glenda and I fly in the flag. Me again, as I say, by this time you don't even think about glamour, you're just glad you've got there. These are just shots of the city, just amazing. And now, this here, I'm going to explain this to you. This is the symbol, the Chicana, and this is their, if you like, their religious symbol. And everything has got this 3-step thing on. Here, yeah, it means the puma, the condor, the puma, and the snake. So it's the higher being, the human, and the lower being. And everything they do to do with religion has that symbol, and you'll see it everywhere in Peru. And the guides all gave us one of these each on the last night, which was lovely, so we were all chuffed with that. But this is called the sunstone, and this is in a part of Machu Picchu where when the sun rises in the morning it hits that stone exactly, which is absolutely amazing. You know, when you think sort of 500 years ago how they worked all that out, but they worked it all out with the stars and everything. And that's another part of the symbol, the top part, the puma, is all about the constellations and the stars and the heavens, and they reckon that the 12 points are to do with the constellation as well. So I have read up about it, but it's this is a little passageway that went through from where the sunstone is, because that was their sort of place of worship. And you went through this rock here, and it came out into a little room the other side, and there was a little area where people still go to this day and leave little offerings and say prayers for people and wish good luck for people who are ill and things like that. And they still do it today. It's mostly cocoa leaves, funny enough. It's one of the things they do, but they leave them. Oh, we're racing on a bit here. Just go back a bit. After the guides had shown us around for about 2 hours, they let us wander about on our own for an hour. And then we got a coach back down to the village at the bottom of the mountain, and we all had the most fantastic lunch laid out for us in a hotel. And the sad thing was, we were there in November, and in the December they had those awful floods, and it was in the same village where we'd had our lunch and everything, which was awful sad because it's all built in this dip. So they were renewing all the railway tracks and, you know, making the town more accessible for visitors and everything. So it was very sad to see it all covered like that. And then we all went back to Cusco on the train. And then we were given 2, well, 1.5 free days then So we could either go on a trip to see a school where they were trying to educate the girls, because the girls are never educated. So they'd set up a special school and they were trying to educate the girls. Or you could go white water rafting, or you could just have a free day on your own. So I thought, right, I'll never be here again, so I'm going white water rafting. So I did. So that was us afterwards. We'd been down this big river. It wasn't, on a scale of sort of 1 to 10, they said the worst of it was about 5. So it wasn't mad, but it was still something I'd never done before, so it was brilliant. And again, they'd set us up lunch by putting an awning on the coach, and they'd if you go into the next picture, I think it will show you Bernie. They'd done us quiche and salad and everything. The food was just absolutely amazing. It was brilliant. And that was out in the middle of nowhere. This is the last night when we had all the local entertainment. You see, all their costumes are really, really colourful. It was brilliant. They have a lot of these sort of pan pipes. This was like a devil's dance. So all these girls had horns and things on, but the costumes were brilliant, so colourful. And okay, and again, that's just a group shot of everybody.
What's this joke
on
his face?
Oh, that was like a knitted mask that some of them wore there for some of the dances, and one of the lads had pinched it off one of the dancers and put it on. So that's the guides again that took us up there. So and back to Paddington. So that's just, let's say, a very brief resume of what we did do, but it was absolutely amazing. And the way we did it, we all had to raise £3,000 or more. And give it to the centenary, to the children's centre, and out of that they paid our fare and all the costs, and everything else went to the children's centre. And I actually managed to raise £3,200, which, considering at the time I decided in the March I would go on it, and then in the July, as you all know, Bernie found he had a brain tumour, and of course it knocked us for six, and all my fundraising went out the window. I managed to do Peel Carnival and a few other things that I'd booked, but my basic fundraising had to stop really as much. And it was just amazing. People just kept sending me cheques and donating money, and it was just amazing. I ended up with over £3,000. So all in all, the whole group, by the time they paid everything, the children's centre ended up with £43,000 from the whole group, which was amazing. So I'm itching to go work somewhere else now. I've got better hang on for this year, but I'm looking at perhaps the Great Wall of China or something next year. But it'll all depend. But say, that's a very brief thing. It was an absolutely amazing experience, and certainly one, I'd say if you get the chance, do it. Even if you don't want to climb it the way I did, go and see it the other way, go on the train, it's brilliant. But I've got my album, so if anybody wants to have a look through, it is getting on a bit. But thank you all for listening anyway.